Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
The Vietnam War, it's over.
Your job's just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft.
Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry, we were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right, ChumbaCasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
You're listening to Stagecraft, Variety's theater podcast, bringing you in-depth interviews with the creators and stars of the hottest shows on Broadway, off Broadway, in London, and around the country. I'm your host, Variety's theater editor, Gordon Cox. On this episode of Stagecraft, I'm talking to Ayad Akhtar, the Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright of Disgraced, whose new play is now being produced on Broadway by Lincoln Center Theater. It's called Junk, and it's about the high-stakes gambit orchestrated by one of the kings of Wall Street during the 1980s junk bond crisis. Ayad's in the studio to tell us all about it. Ayad, thanks for being here.
Nice to be here, Gordon. Thanks.
There's a good story about how you taught yourself the basics of the stock market. Tell it to us.
When I first moved to New York, I was 24. My dad made a deal with me that if I read the Wall Street Journal every day, he'd pay my rent. You know, he and my mom were concerned that, you know, I was reading too much poetry. Right. And how was I ever going to get interested in the real world? And so, you know, knowing his son, the dutiful immigrant son who loved to read, he made me agree to that. And I did. And I started reading the journal every day. There was a library over on 3rd Avenue and 27th Street that I, 29th Street that I used to go to and read the Wall Street Journal there every day. And I started reading Barron's. And, you know, it was that time in New York when it was 95. And it was the beginning of that first tech bull run. So everybody was beginning to make money. And, you know, Tina Brown had just taken over the New Yorker. And profiles of Allen & Co. were sitting cheek by jowl with profiles of Mikhail Baryshnikov. Right. So money was in the sort of culture circles as well. So it was kind of gave me something to talk about with people who actually were part of my world, too. So that got me interested in and got me and become an observer.
Did you move to New York to go to film school or?
No, I moved to New York because I had been working with Jerzy Grotowski in Italy. I'd spent a year working with him and then
studying acting. That's right. I saw that. Yeah.
I was his assistant for a year. And then Andre Gregory, who had just done Vanya on 42nd Street, and I had played his assistant in the movie because I was his assistant at the time. I had come.
Is that true? I'm going to have to watch that again.
Yeah, I'm in it.
I love that movie.
I have hair.
Yeah. Okay. I would.
You will recognize. You like, who is that very serious, skinny young man carrying chairs and standing behind Andre? So Andre had, after doing Vanya on 42nd Street, had said that he wanted to start a group of a new group. And wanted to have a group of older actors and younger actors like Wally and Julianne and Larry Pine, and then a group of younger actors. And would I come to
New York? This is Wallace Shawn.
And Larry Pine. And he had and a group of younger actors that he had been sort of working with who it turned out would later become quite famous, Rainn Wilson and Sam Rockwell. But, you know, we were all just kids at that time. And would I come to New York and be a part of this group, and maybe I could be the person in charge of the younger people and he would be the person in charge of the older people. And so I came to New York really just on that promise to start a group with Andre, only to have Andre, you know, he was maybe not quite as committed to the project as I might have hoped he would be. But what I ended up doing is teaching workshops with him. And so I started teaching acting at that time in New York, and that was why I was here. So,
and so you started, I interrupted you, you started reading the Wall Street Journal and Barron's, and did you invest?
Yeah, my dad would give me some money every year and would, you know, encourage me to put it into the market. And so I started, you know, that's the best way to learn about money is to...
How'd you do?
For the first few years, I did really well, actually. I tripled.
Wow.
I tripled. And then I made a strategic error. And the strategic error was the one that was probably the most beneficial because it really taught me about money. I don't think you really learn until you lose money what it's all about. And, you know, that's the thing. There's something about money becomes very concrete when you lose it. It's not concrete when you make it because right. That feeling of abundance, it's just a feeling. And the feeling of loss, that feels like something much more real.
Yeah. When did you decide that Wall Street was something you wanted to write about?
Well, you know, my very first novel, which was never published, was about a poet working at Goldman Sachs doing the databases at night. And then, you know, I wrote this play called The Invisible Hand, which is basically about the markets. And
right.
So I've been writing about the markets for a long time. I knew that I wanted to write a very large play about American finance, but it wasn't really until...
Do you have a sense of why that was
something
a topic?
Because I think I had felt for some time that finance was becoming the dominant regime, not only politically and economically, but spiritually in America, and that so much of our lives were governed by the kind of imperatives, for example, of constant urge to monetization, which has turned so many human relationships into transactions in this era. You know, all of those ultimately spiritual realities are emanating from the dominance of finance. And I think it's a story that is not told. Nobody is telling that story really. You know, we have wonderful stories like Billions, which celebrate the billionaire swagger and whatnot, but a sort of genetic, critical, insider analysis of the transformation of the American psyche. That's something that I, you know, wanted to start with this play.
Wow. That's a big topic.
Yeah, well... Got to stay busy.
Right. And what was there in the 80s and in the junk bond crisis that you wanted to dig into?
Well, I you know, central questions in American life, like what is value? What is ownership? What is the collective? What is the individual? What is the rightful place of shareholder rights in a democracy? What does it mean for shareholders to own? All of these central things, which are they are so fundamental to how our society is structured, and we don't have meaningful conversations about any of these things. The mid 80s was the last time that these questions were not settled. There was still a sense that there could be another answer to some of these questions. Mid 80s, these questions were settled, and now we live in an era where they're no longer alive. So I wanted to return to a time where the drama of posing these questions in human form would have basis. If you did it today, I think it would just feel like, oh, a bunch of sentimental people who are still worried about workers and whatnot. You know, and that's the other thing is that so often the conflict is cast as one of labor versus management. That's not the battle. That's not the conflict. The conflict is an internal one that has to do with capital. It's about value and debt and stuff that is much more abstract that's really driving the decision-making. You know, labor, the loss of jobs and whatnot, that's a symptom of something that is happening much earlier in the chain.
Right. And we started to talk a little bit about this before we turned the recorder on, but the events depicted in the play are fictional, but they are loosely based on real life people and real life events. Tell us a little bit about
they're composited.
Means.
You know, I just simply from a sort of procedural point of view, not in any way of comparing myself or literary quality or anything like that, but I was looking at that time through the lens of Shakespearean history where, you know,
the very first, if I remember correctly, monologue is about kings, right?
That's right.
Like,
this is
like a
story.
Play,
this
yeah.
is a story of kings, or what passes for kings these days,
right?
Kings, then bedecked in Brooks Brothers and Brioni. Yeah, the idea was to sort of...
Could you do the whole play right now?
Probably. You know, I was sitting in the back the other night, and a couple of people were watching me across the aisle. I was like, what the hell are they watching? The whole play, they kept looking back at me. I was like, what are they looking at? And then at the end, they came up to me. They said, are you the playwright? I said, yeah. They said, wow, because we were watching you mouth the entire play. I didn't even realize I was doing it.
That's funny.
I was just sort of saying all the words.
Right. I cut you off.
I was looking at, you know, through the angle of Shakespearean history, because I felt like what Shakespeare did so well with those plays, which were such popular successes, most of them, and which were such mashups of genre and such fictionalizations of national myths, which both had detail from the truth of those lives and also concoctions. So I wanted to take that as my template and sort of build a story that would have a kind of potentially mythic reach for Americans. And so, yes, I composited some deals that I think still loom large in the history of finance, the Revlon deal and the RJR Nabisco deal and some of those titans like, you know, the Nelson Pelzes and Ron Perelmans and Henry Kravitzes, the financiers like Bruce Wasserstein and Mike Milken. There have been lawyers who were involved in some of these deals. Ivan Boesky's lawyer was there the other night, and another lawyer who was a lawyer on the Revlon deal and used to represent Teddy Forsman, who is part of a composite in the play. I mean, there's a composite of Trump in the play as well. You know, there's and the play, I think, very much speaks to that moment in American history where value became this thing divorced from reality, and where language and meaning were beginning to part, and where the sort of beginning of all of this stuff we're now dealing with, this interweave of irreality and the dominance of finance, you know, where that those bedfellows have now sprung offspring. So
how did you settle on a form for this kind of story, this kind of big? Was it the Shakespeare inspiration that really guided you?
It was. And you know, if I don't want to make the comparison to seem overweening or overly ambitious, or it's just, you know, I cannot control my preoccupations. I just have them. But Henry IV, parts 1 and 2 is my favorite play. And I am always amazed by how much I find myself in all of the portraits, in the portraits of power, in the king, in Hal, in Falstaff, in Bardolph, in Pistol. And I wanted to, I took it as a challenge, is like, well, can you write a play about capital in which all the human dimension of that, not because you see the people at home with their wives and their kids, but you see them in the offices and you see the human interactions. Can you write it in a way that the audience can recognize their own selves in all of those interactions? So I consciously studied, you know, Henry IV, parts 1 and 2. And Tressler is a kind of Falstaffian figure who is a kind of bumbling king wannabe who ends up
very wealthy, bumbling,
very wealthy king wannabe who ends up sort of chickening out at the last minute, much like Falstaff always seems to. So there was, you know, there are all those parallels with.
It's also, we should say for people who haven't seen it, it's a big show. There are what, 18 actors? Is that right?
There are, well, the company's 23,
oh,
with
23.
The ensemble. Okay. But yes, there's 17, I think, speaking roles or speaking actors with 25 roles. We do double up some of those roles. I think that I always knew that I needed a big form. You know, I'd spent some time in London with Disgraced and with The Invisible Hand. And, you know, the Shakespearean dramaturgy of writers like James Graham and you know, it's a very, very alive form right now in London.
Right.
And they're doing these.
Did you see Ink?
I haven't seen Ink. Yeah. No, I'm excited to see it.
Ink is a play about Murdochs.
Murdochs, yeah.
That's James Graham, right?
That's James Graham. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. And, you know, his last play, which I loved, was This House. Right. And I saw it at the Olivier. And, you know, 1,000 people, you know, totally engaged in a absolutely granular depiction of the parliamentary process and riotously funny and totally engaged was like, it kind of set the bar for me. I was like, wow, okay, how to do this. And then, so in doing that, thinking about that, recognizing that all of those dramatists who are writing in that form are working from Shakespeare, you know, in their case, it's less self-conscious because they grow up with it. You know, a writer like myself or an American writer has to really seek it out in a different way.
Right. Yeah. The, stock market can be a hard thing to get your head around, which is one of the things we're talking about. How did you make sure that you could tell your story without audiences' eyes glazing over?
I think that's what I'm trying to do.
Yeah.
I think that my gambit was that if the human reality of a particular interaction is perfectly clear, somebody is lying to somebody else, somebody is behind the eight ball because they're ignoring a situation, somebody is upset, but we don't understand why, and then we realize it's because he's an anti-Semite. If you understand all of those core motivations from scene to scene, if every scene is centered around some very simple human reality, that even if you're not into the finance part of it, you can at least follow along. And then I think, you know, judicious and hopefully mostly invisible instances of exposition falling between active areas can prime the audience to understand a little bit better what's going on.
Right. You mentioned a character who's an anti-Semite. That it's notable in the play that the sense of difference that all these characters have in terms of who's Jewish, who's Cuban, who's, you know, old money.
Right.
Why was that important to the world of this play?
Well, for two reasons. One, it's part of the history of that time. You know, the transformation of America. Tom Brokaw's allegedly greatest generation, you know, giving way to a new generation. And the other part of it that I think is more subtle, and which is, I think, more central to the actual operation of it in the play, is that I wanted to tell a story in which the identity politics enlisted the audience's sympathies and ultimately had nothing to do with the outcome. And so you have characters who win, and we've been rooting for them to win because their causes are just in accordance with our own prevailing morality today, but the world is no better. The world is no better a place because those people are now equal. And I think it was a way to metaphorically undermine this sense of this consumptive obsession that I think we have become lost to in this country. And we're not keeping our eye on the real problem. So that's the more subtle. I don't know how many people will really register with, but you know, that's why you write a play.
What's your take on how identity politics has shifted in the last 30 years? How that situation you're depicting is what's the same and what's different specifically in your view?
Well, I think that, I don't know that much has changed. I think that it's clear that we are in agreement as good people that folks should be allowed to be who they wish to be. I think at that era it was not so obvious. I think that you know, one could say that anti-Semitism is not quite as prevalent reality on the street anymore. I think that's probably true. But I think that, you know, the rise of anti-Semitism within the larger culture over the past, I'd say, few years is, you know, makes that analogy perhaps less interesting. It makes it less interesting that, therefore, because it's not happening on Wall Street, it's still happening elsewhere. Again, to me, it was just, it's the idea that individualism and the expression of individualism and the celebration of individualism, no matter what its consequences, is the ultimate good in American life. I'm not sure that serves us. I think that we have eroded something. I don't think we have a meaningful answer to the question of who we is anymore. What is the collective? How do we, and because we can't answer that, we don't know how to care for it. And so all we do is pursue our own ends. We pursue our own desires, and we believe that that is what it means to be American. And so the play kind of stages the, I think, you know, granular and riotous celebration of that individualism and then lands you where it lands you at the end of the play.
Right.
And part of that is the identity politics in the play.
Right, right.
I mean, you have a black character at the end of the play who's talking about, you know, investing in prisons for profit.
Right, right, yes. Yes.
Right.
Spoiler. And all your previous plays have included Islam as a subject and mm-hmm. had featured Muslim characters,
yeah.
but this one doesn't. Was that a conscious decision on your part?
Well, there would have been no way to... I mean, I've worked a Pakistani doctor into the show.
True.
Right? There was no way to work my community into this play because it was set at a time when we were just getting here. You know, somebody asked me yesterday at the Lincoln Center event, you know, this seems such a departure from Disgraced. I mean, what's so different? And I said, really, is it that different? I mean,
that was my next question is, how is it like your other
work? Well, Amir is a mergers and acquisitions lawyer working at a boutique firm run by a couple of Jewish guys.
This is the main character.
Took over, you know, a lot of business in the mid 80s because they were the ones who knew how to do that work. So basically, Amir's bosses are the guys in this play.
Right.
You know, both Disgraced and Junk have anti-heroes who have dueling fealties, who feel like outsiders, but who are insiders, who are working against prevailing prejudices, and who an audience can never figure out whether they should root for or not root for. So to me, I feel like I look at both plays and I think, well, it's just an expanded version of all of the same substratum. But I think that one of the things that it tells me is that when I put a Muslim character into a play, people think they're watching a play about somebody else, not about themselves. Whereas now I'm writing a play in which so much of the audience thinks that maybe they're like that guy too. And so now they're watching a play about themselves, but it's written by this Muslim guy who always used to write plays about those other people. But to me, those other people were never other people. They were always just people that I know. And these are people that I know. So it's a tricky question because I get it. I get the gestalt sort of thing that's out there, but it's also not what I write from or where I write from.
How do you feel like your experiences with faith influence you as a writer?
I think, you know, it's a good question. I mean, I think that if I can be, you know, if I can tend again to the pretentious dimension, the pretentious end of the spectrum, which I flirt with often, is that I think that for me, the theater at its essence is a kind of temple, but a temple that I in a way try to recreate a kind of sense of something that I experienced as a kid going to mosque, or that there is something special about that space. Something special can happen in that space, that the words that are spoken in that space carry greater meaning for our lives than words spoken elsewhere. And so in a way, I think faith is at the core of what my vision as a writer is in my desire to connect to an audience. Yes, I recognize the essential that I have to entertain. I have to give pleasure, but I'm ultimately always doing that to do something else. And I think that's fundamentally faith-driven in a way.
And
does that make sense?
That does. It does. And we were just talking about Disgraced, your 2013 play, which won the Pulitzer. How does that, what's your take on how that influences a playwright's career?
Well, you know, when I won, or, you know, I was like that locution.
That was your first play, by the way, yes?
Yes, it was, yeah. It's not that I've been writing for 25 years. Yes, but
granted,
no, but I
granted.
Often,
and you've written a novel.
Yes,
and,
yeah. I've written three, only one of which had been published. And I'd written, you know, 9 screenplays. And I often say that when I had the great good fortune of winning the Pulitzer, even though that locution is very odd to me because I wasn't running a race or I didn't win anything. I just got a call one day. Actually, I got a call from Philip Rinaldi at Lincoln Center and said, "Hey, Ed, you've won the 2013 Pulitzer Prize." And my response was, do you have that on authority? Is this a crank call? And I thought to myself, well, very little good can come of this. Because either I believe it, and if I believe it, that is going to kind of estrange me from my own vulnerability and my own awareness of my weaknesses that I have to keep working on to become a better writer. And that in a way, that friction and that anxiety is what drives my creativity. Or I could not believe it and start writing defensively to prove that I deserve it, in which case I would perhaps identify more strongly with the weaknesses than I need to and not trust my strengths. So I thought, well, what's the way around this? The way around this is to take a huge artistic risk, is to do something, to take it as a sign of encouragement to go and try it. And that was, you know, that was when I decided I'd been wanting to write a very big play about finance. And I thought, you know, now maybe
because that's a good point. Your previous plays have been relatively small.
Yeah, they're small in terms of the scope of their storytelling.
Right.
And so I thought this is maybe the time that if I write a play that's got 17 actors in it, I could actually get it produced because of this window. And so let me use it as an encouragement to try something hard. So that's, you know, as far as how it affects, you know, a career, there was that article in Variety that came out when I won, said, well, you know, let's look at what it does for a playwright's career. Well, it's not that much money. It's only $10,000. And, well, you know, the last few Pulitzers, they haven't been on Broadway, so it doesn't necessarily get you to Broadway. What it does guarantee you is an obit in the New York Times. I will say this. People are interested in reading my work, artistic directors and literary managers and whatnot. And that's a great boon because I didn't have that before.
As you mentioned, you worked on screenplays because you went to film school, which is a thing haven't really talked about. You've also been working on a couple of television projects, as I understand it. Yeah,
I'm working on a show for FX right now about the 80s and Hollywood and the transformation of the storytelling business because of the middleman, the lawyer, the agent, and the financier. So, you know,
what's it called? Do you know yet?
I don't have a title and I'm deep in a new draft. So, but, you know, if it goes well, you'll hopefully hear about it. Certainly at Variety, you'll hear about it, but
yeah. What is it about theater that you can't do in any of those other forms that you mentioned? What keeps you coming back to theater, and when is an idea specifically suited for theater?
To me, it's about presence. And it's about the thing I said earlier, was that language in the presence of others in a theater can have a heightened, almost numinous effect at its best. I have never experienced that anywhere else. I have never experienced that on a screen. And I think that the sense of encounter with a performer and the audience in a space together, it can reach down deep into us into some ritual, sort of almost mythic. It doesn't happen often, but it can. The possibility for that is there. You know, I think that I just love the theater so much. I love the process of theater. I love rehearsal. I love the collaboration. I love the encounter with the audience, as grueling as previews are. And my God, it's the most grueling time in my life is a preview period, and especially on Broadway when your show is in front of 1,000 people a night and you got to be open-hearted, and any rationalizations about what you think is working but the audience doesn't think is working is a liability. So you got to get rid of all of that, and you got to be open for 3.5 weeks. It's just brutal. But there's something incredibly, I don't know, renewing about it. It kind of puts you back, whatever illusions you have about who you are and how good you are, what you think you're doing. You are forced to confront yourself in a way that I think is ultimately very productive.
I think that's a great place for us to stop. Thank you for talking with us, Ed.
And thank you, Courtney.
Your new play, Junk, is on stage at Lincoln Center right now.
Thank you, sir.
That was Ayad Akhtar, the Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright whose newest play, Junk, is now playing at Lincoln Center Theater. Next time on Stagecraft, I'll be talking to Beau Willimon, the creator of House of Cards, whose new play, The Parisian Woman, stars Uma Thurman on Broadway. Until then, see you at the theater.
If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but
yeah.
Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org, because only together we rise.